This is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by West Virginia University, offering education, healthcare, and the opportunity to achieve career success since 1867. Information at go.wvu.edu/forward.
Welcome to the legislature today. I'm Randy Yowie. As we come to the last few days of this session, committee meetings are mostly done as bills have to be on the floor to give the chambers 3 days to vote on them. There are, of course, ways around that. They can suspend the rules on a bill and pass it in 1 day, but generally, everything should be reported to the House or Senate floor by now. Also, earlier today, Governor Jim Justice issued a proclamation to extend the legislative session by 1 day to allow the legislature to finalize the state budget bill. There has been discussion about a special session in May, perhaps, to finalize questions regarding a potential federal clawback of COVID-19 relief funds. On third reading in the House of Delegates, there was a long debate over minorities purchasing car dealerships, and another contested debate over control of the legislative auditor's office. Other proposals included smoking in the car with a child and taking action over a massive federal deficit. Senate Bill 173 modifies guidelines for motor vehicle dealers, distributors, wholesalers, and manufacturers. The lengthy bill covers numerous automotive sales industry guidelines. Debate on the bill, a bill that failed last session, focused on a car manufacturer's right of first refusal. That's a clause in a contract that gives a prioritized interested party the right to make the first offer on purchasing a West Virginia car dealership before the manufacturer can negotiate with other prospective buyers. Delegate Mike Pushkin, a Democrat from Kanawha County, proposed an amendment enhancing opportunities for qualified persons who are part of a group who have been historically underrepresented in buying car dealerships.
The intent of this bill was to preserve a good old boy system. The intent of this bill was to keep the manufacturer from selling to minority owners. And then the question was like, do you mean less than 50%? No, minority as in racial minority or women. So I don't think that's what the intent of this bill should be. So let's prove what the real intent is.
The amendment was rejected. Delegate Daniel Linville, a Republican from Gable County and the bill's sponsor, said the proposal sets a level playing field in the competitive and lucrative auto dealer industry.
To set a level playing field for all of the interactions between some of the very largest organizations that are publicly traded entities, the manufacturers of these automobiles, and their local dealers. Frankly, I think that we stand for free markets. I think that, as has been said, you should be able to sell your business to who you wish, without the ability for that to come in and be assigned and placed somewhere else.
Senate Bill 173 passed 87-13. Investigating possible wrongdoing or mismanagement within state agencies and departments is the job of the Legislative Auditor's Office. Senate Bill 687 would clarify the Legislative Auditor's scope of authority. The bill would have the auditor responsible to the Joint Committee on Government and Finance, and that the auditor may exercise powers at the discretion of the Senate President or Speaker of the House of Delegates. A sustained litany from those opposed to the bill, including Delegate Larry Rowe, a Democrat from Kanawha County, noted a lack of investigative independence and transparency with the revised scope of authority.
We want somebody that we can trust to tell us the truth. And we want that truth to be made public and fairly. This bill is a takeover of the Legislative Auditor's Office. It's eliminating the independent, professional decision-making and investigations that they perform. There's no complaint about the service that they have performed.
But the bill sponsor, Delegate Adam Berkhammer, a Republican from Lewis County, said investigating and auditing will be enhanced by this bill.
There's been some conversation about that this should be an independent auditor. And I would completely disagree with that notion, because the very idea of the legislative auditor is to work for this body. He's appointed by the committee to serve at its will and pleasure. That committee is the Joint Committee on Government and Finance, appointed by that committee to work for its will and pleasure, to serve this body, so that we can make sound policy decisions on the direction that we want the state to go.
Senate Bill 687, the legislative auditor bill, passed with a 56-41 vote and goes to the governor's desk. In committee and on the Senate floor, debate over Senate Bill 378, prohibiting smoking in a vehicle when minors 16 or under is present, centered on health versus freedom. But in the House, no debate, as the bill passed by a 66-33 margin and goes to the governor's desk. A charge for lawmakers here and in Washington, D.C. to take action on a multi-trillion dollar federal deficit is at the root of House Concurrent Resolution 57. It demands that Congress call a convention of states to propose amendments to the U.S. Constitution to create federal fiscal responsibility. Delegate Bill Ridenhour, a Republican from Jefferson County, is the resolution sponsor. He said this is not a duplicate of a 2022 resolution, but a call for congressional action to not have the state and nation fall into a fiscal abyss.
Every 90 days, we're adding $1 trillion in debt to the U.S. debt. We're on the edge of a fiscal abyss, and we've got to do something. We as a nation have to do something, but we in this body have to do something as well. We have a responsibility under federalism to act with the federal government, with the states, to try and take action that will have some impact on where we're going as a nation.
Countering concerns were of a possibly open-ended convention that might get away from the fiscal point. The resolution was adopted with a 79-18 vote. And Senate Bill 170 deals with workers' compensation health care coverage, establishing rebuttal presumption of injury for certain covered firefighters that develop bladder cancer, mesothelioma, and testicular cancer. The bill passed 99-0 and goes to the governor's desk. Today, the Senate passed 18 House bills, some of which head to the governor's desk and the others back to the House to concur on changes. Some notable bills in the Senate today were on topics like renewable energy, pornography, and cybersecurity. Brianna Heaney has more.
Some of the largest coal power plants in the state can generate more than 1,000 megawatts. Currently, renewable energy facilities are limited to a capacity of 50 megawatts. A bill passed by the Senate and headed to the governor's desk seeks to change that. House Bill 5528 would double the allowed amount from 50 megawatts to 100 megawatts. Senator Glenn Jeffries, a Republican from Putnam County, chairs the Economic Development Committee that the bill was in after passing in the House.
This will allow the regulated utilities to construct larger and more cost-effective facilities.
Jeffries says this could attract business to the state.
There's a number of companies here in West Virginia and other companies that have made interest in West Virginia. They would like to have solar part of their business model.
House Bill 4867 would require pornography websites to utilize age verification methods to prevent minors from accessing content. Senator Trump, a Republican from Morgan County, chairs the Judiciary Committee that saw the bill after it passed in the House. He said the legislation is modeled after legislation in Virginia. It would impose a $10,000 fine per day on sites that fail to comply with the law.
Mr. President, the bill requires that anybody who's going to publish that sort of content as a primary activity on the web has to do real age verification to verify that the people who are accessing those websites and that material are not minor children.
A different bill regarding cybersecurity had a lot of debate today. The bill would loosen companies' liabilities in the case of a data breach where sensitive information was inadvertently leaked. Four senators, three of whom are attorneys, stood to oppose the bill. Senator Mark Hunt, a Republican from Kanawha County, said the bill provides absolute immunity to companies as long as they make some attempt to protect their cyber information. He said he was also concerned that the bill had not been seen by the Judiciary Committee that he serves on.
I'm not sure this bill has any financial impact. I think this is a bill that should have been vetted by Judiciary. It is a tort reform bill. It is an immunity bill. There's no doubt that cybersecurity is important in West Virginia, and it's important to the United States.
Senator Eric Tarr, a Republican from Putnam County and chair of the Finance Committee, where the bill was reviewed after it passed the House, refuted the claims of absolute or blanket immunity.
What this does for businesses and the people of West Virginia is that it strongly incentivizes businesses to have a program that protects the data that they collect. And if they're doing it right, and if they're doing it by standards that are recognized in the industry, they have a reduced liability for doing everything they could possibly do to protect that data.
For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brianna Heaney in Charleston.
A state Senate committee heard new details Wednesday about how the Pleasants Power Station will be converted from coal to hydrogen. Curtis Tate has that story.
The Pleasants Power Station is a 1,300-megawatt power plant along the Ohio River north of Parkersburg. Its coal-fired boilers went cold in June when its then-owner, Energy Harbor, shut them down. But state lawmakers, including Senator Donna Boley, a Pleasants County Republican, fought to save the plant from closure. Not long after the plant went idle, a California company called Omnis Technology stepped in. Omnis reactivated the plant. Its ultimate goal, though, is to produce graphite on the site and use the hydrogen byproduct to generate electricity. Burning hydrogen emits no carbon dioxide. However, the source of that hydrogen at Pleasants will still be coal. Steve Winberg, the former Assistant Secretary of Fossil Energy in the Trump administration, explained to the Senate Energy, Industry, and Mining Committee how the process would work. Winberg joked to lawmakers about his role in firing up the plant more than 40 years ago.
So Pleasants Power Station, again, I started that plant up in 1978 and 79, and I will modestly tell you that's why it's still in operation, because I started it. Otherwise, I'm sure they would have torn it down by now. I just want to see if you're awake. So what they're going to do, you see in the left-hand side, that's the Pleasant Station. About the center right of the screen is where they're going to build out the hydrogen production facility. And the plan is they're going to bring a module in. They're going to produce hydrogen initially with natural gas, test it out. So they'll produce hydrogen and graphite. And then they will send the hydrogen to the Pleasants Power Station, probably co-firing with coal and natural gas or hydrogen, and then build out the hydrogen production facility. Their goal is to convert Pleasants from coal to 100% hydrogen and then make the hydrogen from the coal. So at a minimum, we'll see the same amount of coal going to Pleasants, but it will be converted to hydrogen, and then the hydrogen will be burned in the boiler. So there's going to have to be a retrofit on that boiler to allow it to burn hydrogen and still maintain the 600 megawatts that it's capable of maintaining or producing.
Winberg explained to the committee that the technology is emerging. It requires heating the coal to 3,000 degrees Celsius. The bar the process has to clear is producing hydrogen that's cheaper than natural gas.
If this technology works, it will be cost competitive with natural gas. And so proof is in the pudding. We'll see if they're able to get it to work at 3,000 degrees. But if they do, it's a pretty intriguing technology.
Omnis is investing $800 million into the facility. If successful, it will need 600 workers to operate in addition to the 160 who run the current plant. For the Legislature Today, I'm Curtis Tate.
Our reporter covering the state Senate, Brianna Heaney, got a chance this afternoon to speak with two leaders from the upper chamber to discuss where things stand and how that compares to what they plan to do at the beginning of the session.
Today, I am sitting here with Senator Woeful, a Democrat from Cabell County, and Senator Oliverio, a Republican from Monongalia County. And we're going to talk about the last 59 days. All right, so let's start off with legislative priorities. At the very beginning, childcare was kind of a bipartisan legislative priority. At this point, a lot of those bills, the majority of those bills, have not made it to the deadline. What happened? Let's start with you.
You know, I'm the fellow for West Virginia with the Hunt Institute. And the Hunt Institute's an educational nonprofit, and one of the big priorities of the Hunt Institute is early child care programs, you know, the 0 to 3, 0 to 4 age commitments. And I'd like to see us do more in that area. I'm not going to give up on it. I'm going to continue to work on that in the years ahead. But I think the state in the United States that can figure out how to best deliver early child care will be the state that will leapfrog ahead of many others.
That's an interesting point.
Well, I had three bills that were introduced day one for child care tax credits. And the governor echoed that sentiment at the State of the State, and we got not one bill moved an inch. So I'm very disappointed about that. I've repeatedly asked leadership about in the Senate about why we aren't moving, helping working West Virginians. It's not a handout. It's a reimbursement of money they pay out so that they can go to work and expand our workforce. Child poverty is 25% and rising in West Virginia. So people need to work. Kids need to have working parents. And I think because of our tax cuts last year, there's no money to even start a conversation with child care tax credits.
I think it's interesting, not only do we have a Democrat and Republican, but we also have two people from the two perspective committees, Finance Committee and Judiciary Committee. Talk to me about what happened to these bills. Why didn't they make it to the finish line?
You know, I think one of the big challenges we had this year in putting the budget together, a roughly $5 billion budget, was a $700, $750 million uncertainty of this potential clawback from the federal government with respect to education funding. And I think it kind of paralyzed us for a while during the session. And I hope we're through it. We think we're through it. And with getting through that, there might be opportunities for us to do more with some of these priorities.
That's a very finance answer. What happened in judiciary?
Well, I mean, this is anything we have to do that costs money, particularly the child care tax credit bill, which had my bill had a $1 million price tag on it. So it was focused just on working people that are in the middle class and want to be in the middle class. And so it's not a huge ask. I just think it's a matter of priorities. And we both agree on the need, but, you know, it just wasn't considered a priority. And there are some uncertainties, but the last time I checked, we were hearing about a $1 billion surplus. And up until recently, the tax revenue estimates were beating them every quarter for as long as I can remember. So, yes, there are variables, including this potential clawback, but I think the priorities are the priorities. And sadly, that's that.
Okay. Let's shift to transparency and independence. From the legislative auditor's bill to the EBA bill, both were shrouded in lacks of transparency. One bill reduces the auditor's investigative independence and the other some journalistic independence. There also originally was a lot of confusion around what the bills actually do. How do bills like this serve the public?
I think one of the things that changed with respect to the legislative auditor was there was an individual who had been in the position for many years. And as that person announced their retirement, I think the legislative leadership looked for, do we just replace that one person or do we change the structure? And the decision was to evaluate maybe changing that structure as to how that's done. And so I think that's part of what triggered that change stepping back and maybe a reevaluation. Certainly, we want our legislative auditors to be able to look throughout state government and try to find inefficiencies, try and find fraud. And so, I mean, that's my commitment to do that.
You do a great job on the West Virginia public television, which is, I think, part of your question. And I was against taking an independent entity and putting it into the government. I really think that is going to end up being something we regret, and I'll tell you why. You know, the governor, whoever the governor is going to be using that as a mouthpiece. I mean, it's part of his government now that he's in charge of, as opposed to an independent entity. I wonder whether people are going to be getting tax deductions for charitable contributions. I question that since it's a government entity. I really think that it takes away from transparency. It detracts from freedom of the press. I think it's a horrible move, and I'm against it. But, you know, it's going to happen.
Mm. Let's take another dramatic shift to committee wars. The Crown Act was kind of at the heart of the committee wars. I mean, you saw it go through judiciary, went to finance, died in finance. Then last night in judiciary, the Crown Act was essentially amended into a separate bill. That got shot down because it was said not to be germane to that original bill. Talk to me about, especially being in judiciary, about it not being germane and everything like that.
Well, whether something is germane is sort of a call of the parliamentarian, and I don't really question that. I don't have any expertise in that area. The call was made; it was not considered to be germane, and that's how the process works. So I commend Senator Trump, you know, for trying to move that last night, but it was a strategy that failed, and you move on to the next bill.
Yeah, a lot of people will say this is politics, but a lot of these moves, especially the move of the bill into finance committee and then never being taken up in finance committee, a lot of people saw that as a very highly political move and to keep the bill from actually really being voted on. Are we serving the public best by moving bills to committee and letting them die instead of just voting on them on the floor?
You know, that bill ended up being referred to finance, and it wasn't that there wasn't any discussion about it. I think there are a lot of us on the finance committee, maybe all of us on the finance committee, that feel strongly about protections for race and religion, ethnicity, and all those kinds of things. So I don't necessarily think that was really the driving force. I think, you know, evaluating the issues we have before us and the decision was kind of made to move on. It wasn't that it wasn't discussed when it came to finance. It was discussed in caucus. I think in a way it received a fair hearing, and the decision in the end was to not pursue it at this time.
Okay, let's talk about some more stuff that's happening in committee, especially on that topic of amending bills and those bills being germane. 741, Senate Bill 741, pretty likable bill across party lines. It got no votes in the Senate or in the House. That bill was amended, though, with a House bill that was a Senate Bill 741 was a bill that would make it criminal for anybody to make like AI child porn, essentially. That was amended with another House bill, a very controversial House bill on library obscenities. Again, these kind of political moves, how are we, what's the idea behind these? How are we serving the public instead of just kind of having these bills go straight forward to a floor vote and versus these kind of workaround ways?
Mm-hmm. I'll take that one.
Okay.
So I ask myself each day, what are we doing to keep West Virginians here and to attract other people? We hear statements from politicians here in the House. Libraries and museums are havens for pedophiles, and that grooming goes on there, and that the Statue of David depicting a male with no clothing on, that could be considered potentially obscenity. So when you have that culture divisive argument, it drives people away. It detracts from the real business, and I know that Senator agrees with me on that, but that's what happened there. Somebody's grudge, somebody's political agenda got in the way of a good bill, and that's that.
Senator Oliverio, talk to me about these strategies.
Well, understand that there's 134 legislators, and they see things very differently at times. Understand also that there has to be a process for this to work. And within that process, leaders are able to make decisions, a speaker, a Senate president, a committee chair. And so you have to try to find a way to work within that process. And sometimes we get into these cultural issues, which my preference would be on, you know, the early childhood, the economic development issues, the education, the health care, those kinds of issues. But there are people who oftentimes bring those issues, and then, you know, we kind of have to deal with them and try to figure out what makes sense. And I hated that the legislation in the House seemed to criminalize librarians. These are people oftentimes very underpaid. They're very committed to what they're doing. And I hated that as that legislation morphed and moved around, that it came off in that manner.
All right, we've got just under a minute left. Let's kind of end on this note. The getting things done in the Senate and keeping them straight sometimes seem to be a little bit at odds, as we're talking about. Any last comments on that?
I think you have to work within the committee structure. There are times you might not like the outcome, but you try to work within it. You try to bring the best ideas and work through that. You know, the process is designed for legislation to fail. Remember, that's how it's designed, so that only very best pieces can survive.
All right, I'll let you close it out.
It's a matter of priorities. We did nothing for foster care the whole session. What are your priorities? The leadership has the agenda. They have the hammer. They go with their priorities. So again, foster children, of whom there are 7,000 in our state right now, unserved, unhelped during this session.
Okay. Well, I so appreciate you guys sitting down and talking with me. I know that you guys both have to run back to the Senate for, is this the fourth, or I guess this is technically the third? The third
session today.
So I so appreciate, and have a great last 2 days.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for spending this time with us. There are hundreds of bills introduced each session. Only a fraction of those get passed. We aren't able to talk about every bill in a half-hour show, but you can browse the legislature's website under Bill Status and select Completed Legislation to see what has passed and where things stand. We've only got one more episode of this show, but Saturday we will broadcast the final hours of the legislature live as well. I'm Randy Yohe. For everyone here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thanks for joining us, and have a great evening.
Support for the legislature today is provided by West Virginia University, offering education, healthcare, and the opportunity to achieve career success since 1867. Information at go.wvu.edu/forward.